Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with an update of new stories and, in some cases, updating of old stories or old investigative avenues vis-a-vis the assassination of President Kennedy. In this update, we're also going to present a new development in the investigation, the ongoing and tortuous investigation into the assassination of Robert Kennedy as well. We're going to begin by continuing with a reading and partial analysis of a very fine article that was sent to me by a listener. This comes from High Times Magazine's issue of March of 1996. It's by author Dick Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L, the author of the landmark book, The Man Who Knew Too Much. This is a story, or actually a book about the Kennedy assassination, which centers on the life and operations of Richard K. Snagel, a longtime U.S. intelligence operative, who maintains that he was assigned by a KGB contingent that had infiltrated the CIA to assassinate Lee Harvey Oswald before he could be fingered as the patsy for the assassination of President Kennedy because of the Soviets' fear that the Soviets and or their Cuban proxies might be fingered as the culprits in the Kennedy assassination. Indeed, there was and continues to be a great deal of disinformation pointing in the direction of the Soviets and or Cubans, whereas it's quite obvious that fascist elements within our own national security establishment in all probability operating in conjunction with an international fascist milieu involving elements in both Asia and Europe as well as Latin America were the actual authors of President Kennedy's assassination. We have been taking a look at the strange death of Richard K. Snagel, who died of apparently natural causes, although we should note that it has long been an operational capability of not only America's but other countries' intelligence services to assassinate someone in such a manner as to make the death appear to be either a natural death or a suicide or some other form of demise. Richard K. Snagel was going to be questioned by the Assassination Records Review Board, who had taken an interest in his situation as a result of the landmark Dick Russell book. Again, both hardcover and softcover editions, Carroll and Graff Publishers, copyright 1992. That, again, is the Dick Russell book, The Man Who Knew Too Much. The Assassination Records Review Board was going to interview Snagel, had sent him a letter shortly before he was found dead, and then Richard K. Snagel turned up dead in Los Angeles. Another important element of the article that we have reviewed and or we have examined in our first two update segments, the previous two half-hour segments, concerns the book Oswald and the CIA by author John Newman. This book is based on recently declassified documents or features information from recently declassified documents, and it indicates that, in fact, the CIA was very much interested in Lee Harvey Oswald long before he turned up as the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. There is also considerable speculation concerning the possibility of Oswald being a CIA, quote, dangle, unquote, that is to say a CIA, part of a CIA ruse in order to detect a Soviet mole within U.S. intelligence that was, according to some speculation, involved with the CIA's top-secret U-2 spy plane project. Oswald was involved with the U-2. It is now quite well known as a result of the work of not only Dick Russell, but author John Loftus and his cohort Mark Ahrens in their books Unholy Trinity and also The Secret War Against the Jews, that in fact there was a considerable degree of penetration by Soviet intelligence of U.S. intelligence. I think it is a pretty safe bet that the reverse was also the case, or is also the case. Once again, we're going to continue with the article Oswald and the CIA by Dick Russell, the author of The Man Who Knew Too Much. This was featured in High Times Magazine's issue of March of 1996, and research credit on this goes to a listener. Skipping well into the article and resuming after what we examined last, speaking of not only the John Newman book Oswald and the CIA, but also the Norman Mailer book Oswald's Tale, the author writes, "While each of these latest books on the assassination unearths some new ground, particularly Newman's sometimes ponderous but meticulous scrutiny of the CIA's all-too-evident operational interest in Oswald long before November 22, 1963, the real breakthroughs are likely to follow in the coming months from the Assassination Records Review Board. The ARRB ran up against FBI stonewalling last August after voting for full release of 15 records, which the Bureau then appealed directly to President Clinton to continue to withhold on, quote, national security, unquote, grounds. The ARRB has come under fire from some assassination researchers for complying with FBI and CIA requests to keep back certain files, quote, relating to sensitive intelligence sources and methods, unquote. Still, what's been publicly released so far, with the promise of much more to come before the ARRB mandate expires late in 1997, has given additional fuel to conspiracy researchers. We now know, for example, that David Phillips, the CIA's covert action chief in Mexico City, was in Washington on October 1, 1963, waiting to pick up, quote, bulk materials, unquote. These probably included manuscripts of conversations between Oswald and Moscow's Soviet embassy, some of which appear to have involved an Oswald imposter. By the way, we dealt with the possibility of an Oswald imposter in Switzerland in the late 1950s in an article that we read, or that I read, in the first of these half-hour JFK assassination update segments. Continuing, and by the way, this next item we are going to take up in greater length, at greater length in our next segment. We also know that, as early as February of 1961, Phillips, that's the aforementioned David Attlee Phillips, was supervising a CIA operation against the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a one-man chapter of which Oswald established in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. Phillips was working in tandem with James McCord, a CIA agent later involved in the Watergate scandal. As far back as 1976, both Phillips and McCord were cited in cryptic comments by Richard Nagel as having played some role in the CIA's relationship with Oswald. Until a CIA file released by the ARRB last September, the CIA had always refused to acknowledge its use of double agents against the Soviets. However, a November 29, 1963 cable relating to its Mexico City operations states that CIA, quote, double agents have not had meetings with the Sovs or Soviets since assassination, unquote. This is further substantiation for the agency's utilization of operatives like Nagel. According to Noel Twyman, T-W-Y-M-A-N, a San Diego researcher who was able to speak to Nagel twice over the telephone in the months before his death, he expressed renewed fear for his life, but said his private files were in safekeeping. Nagel added that there are individuals still alive who would be greatly, quote, embarrassed, unquote, in the event his materials should come to light. Two police officers entering Nagel's residence after his body was discovered found no evidence of anything having been disturbed. A number of weapons were inventoried, and the house was sealed off by the L.A. coroner's office, pending the arrival of an executor named by Nagel for his estate. An LAPD officer was said to be watching the house to make sure that nobody broke in. Meantime, a curious message went from the coroner's office to the L.A. public administrator, which is in charge of estate arrangements. Quote, when entering the house, beware of traps or pitfalls due to deceased's CIA background connections, unquote, it said. Clearly, L.A. officials realized this was no ordinary case. Richard Case Nagel died as he lived, alone and holding his cards close to his vest. The Assassination Records Review Board did make contact with his executor, but what transpired next is being held closely by Washington. Will the world soon know the full story of, quote, the man who knew too much, unquote? For now, it is a waiting game. Indeed. It is a waiting game, and I want to encourage listeners to this program to continue to follow the case of Richard Case Nagel, no pun intended. Again, the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, a huge volume, out of print now, I believe, but still available from used bookstores, is a read, so to speak, that is well worth the investment of both time and money. I think it's one of the most important and arguably the most comprehensive JFK assassination book ever. And again, that article, research credit on that to a listener from High Times issue of March of 1996. It's by Dick Russell, the author of The Man Who Knew Too Much, and it's entitled Oswald and the CIA. More concerning release of documents by the Assassination Records Review Board, a small item concerning FBI interest in longtime Warren Commission critic Mark Lane. Mark Lane, the author of Rush to Judgment and A Citizen's Descent, was one of the earliest and best known of the Warren Commission critics. I think Rush to Judgment is one of the better early critiques of the Warren Report. However, Mark Lane is not an individual I particularly think a great deal of for a variety of reasons, which needn't be discussed in any detail here, his association with the People's Temple being one of those. Following article is from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, July 4th of 1996. In its Washington section, we find the following small item. Mark Lane, who transformed himself from an obscure New York State Assembly member into perhaps the most vocal critic of the Warren Commission, was shadowed by FBI agents during appearances dealing with President Kennedy's assassination. FBI files, just released by the U.S. Assassination Records Review Board, show that agents were secretly assigned during the 1960s to attend Lane's speeches on the assassination and report on them to then-director J. Edgar Hoover. Lane, 69, who practices law in Washington, could not be reached for comment Wednesday. And so, again, there was apparently a considerable amount of interest on the part of the FBI in some of the things Mark Lane had to say. In this morning's San Francisco Chronicle, today, by the way, for the record being July 5th of 1996, the day on which I'm recording this segment, there was yet another story on yet another possible development vis-a-vis the ongoing investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. This was an enormous event, and apparently it touched a great many lives, and although I personally am very disappointed in the work of the bulk of the JFK assassination research community, which in many ways I think has continued to go over the same ground, although perhaps expanding that somewhat. At the same time, there are a great many researchers who have done terrific work, and the event itself, the assassination of President Kennedy, because it touched so many lives, and because there are so many Americans of sincerely patriotic orientation, that event continues to spark new investigations and new legal machinations. One of those was discussed once again in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, July 5th of 1996. The following article is by Michael Taylor of the San Francisco Chronicle. It's headlined, Judge Sues Over JFK Information, subtitled, He Wants CIA to Answer Questions on Mystery Man. The article reads, It was the kind of case any hard-boiled DA or cop might look at skeptically. A Central Valley woman believes her mysterious boyfriend was in a CIA conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy, and she fears for her life. The boyfriend tells her that Lee Harvey Oswald, the reputed assassin, was just an innocent bystander, and that others fired the fatal shots. Top-secret government codes are found on papers in his house. Evidence about the man's possible complicity in the assassination is given to congressional investigators, and then disappears during a burglary in Washington. The CIA refuses to talk about it. And then, years later, the boyfriend dies of a heart attack just hours before he is to be interviewed by the district attorney and a sheriff's detective. Oliver Stone, where are you? Again, this that is in the article itself, more snide editorial commentary being directed towards Oliver Stone, an individual who does not deserve it, and an individual who, along with Jim Garrison, the central figure in the Stone film JFK, well, I believe that both men are genuine American heroes and have not received the credit due them. Continuing. This may sound like the kind of far-fetched tale concocted by wild-eyed conspiracy theorists, but in fact, it is the stuff of a lawsuit filed in federal court in Fresno by a respected Madera County judge acting as a private citizen, one who does not like it when the CIA tells him to get off its case. The judge, who was the district attorney at the time, is David Minier, M-I-N-I-E-R, 61, and he now sits on the municipal court bench in Chowchilla. He gained a certain fame in the 1970s for prosecuting three young men who had kidnapped 26 Chowchilla schoolchildren and their bus driver. 2 years ago, using the Freedom of Information Act, he sued the CIA after the agency refused to tell Minier whether Claude Barnes Capehart, C-A-P-E-H-A-R-T, had ever been employed by the CIA, and whether Capehart was in Dallas in November of 1963 when Kennedy was assassinated. A federal judge dismissed Minier's lawsuit, but Minier, who was doing all the legal work himself, is appealing the decision to the U.S. Court of Appeals in San Francisco. The judge may be tilting at windmills. Thousands of books and articles over the past 33 years have failed to come up with a definitive solution to Kennedy's death, the Warren Commission's report notwithstanding. By the way, that is less than accurate. In fact, it is quite apparent at this point that there was a conspiracy involving fascist elements within our national security establishment, apparently operating in conjunction as with fascist elements abroad in both Asia, Europe, and Latin America, as I've said, to kill President Kennedy. By the way, before we resume with this article, though, although it appears almost certain that some elements, again, note the use of the term elements of the CIA, were part of this conspiracy, at the same time, it appears that those elements were not operating under the orders of the CIA, and that, in fact, those elements disagreed with much of the CIA's orientation and fell well to the right of the CIA as a whole, and were operating without the permission of their CIA masters. At the same time, it appears that the agency itself was compromised by the participation of those CIA elements, albeit working under orders not coming from the CIA. I would also note in this regard that the CIA is a relatively small part of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. It only gets 15% of the federal budget for intelligence, and although one hears a great deal about the CIA, other intelligence agencies such as the NSA and DIA are in fact much more important. One doesn't hear as much about them, that at least in my opinion. That is to say, I consider them more important. Continuing with this particular article, but Minier says he is suing the CIA to release the Kennedy assassination documents as a way to preserve this, quote, historical research, unquote, on the public record for generations to come, quote, I wanted to get it into some form of permanent record, unquote, he said earlier this week, again quoting, so that if there's any validity to this thing, then the information will be there as a resource. Anything you file in court is there for all time, and someone may come along who has a lot more ability in doing research than I do, and the material will still be there, unquote. Minier's odd quest about the Kennedy assassination started nearly 20 years ago when Capehart, that's Mr. Barnes Capehart, when Capehart moved to Chowchilla and opened a well drilling business. Soon, Capehart came to the county sheriff's office and said some men had been sent from, quote, back east, unquote, to kill him. Sergeant Dale Fore, or Forey, F-O-R-E, said he would look into it. But after scouring the dusty Central Valley town, population 6,000, he could find no assassins. But Capehart seemed like an interesting guy to Fore, and soon he was confiding to the sergeant that he had done some work for the CIA. After a while, Fore called a friend at the FBI and asked about Capehart. Both men concluded that Capehart was a fake, but Minier and Fore were later told by a retired FBI agent that Capehart had been employed by the CIA. Capehart had told his female friend that he had once worked on industrialist Howard Hughes' Glomar Explorer, a deep-sea research vessel that, under CIA sponsorship, raised a Soviet submarine from the floor of the Pacific Ocean in 1968. In 1978, Kennedy assassination theories were at such a full boil in the United States that Congress formed the House Select Committee on Assassinations and began digging into tons of muck raked up over the preceding 15 years by dozens of investigators. Back in Chowchilla, Capehart's female friend, who had seen newspaper photographs of possible assassination conspirators being sought by the committee's investigators, came to Fore and said Capehart's face was in one of the pictures. The woman, who still fears retribution and declines to be publicly identified even years after Capehart's death, said Capehart told her he was, quote, in the Texas school book depository when the president was shot, and Oswald wasn't the only one involved at that time, unquote. Fore wrote in his police report, which ended up as part of Minier's lawsuit. She also reportedly said, quote, Oswald was not the person who shot the president. Capehart showed her a handgun with a silencer, automatic firearms, a cyanide pistol, and passports under an assumed name, unquote. Capehart, apparently disturbed by the publicity of the congressional investigation, moved to Pahrump, Nevada to lie low. Then the woman brought Fore a sheet filled with what appeared to be ciphers. She said she had found it in Capehart's papers. Fore added it to his file. So far we have seen allegations brought up to a girlfriend of Mr. Capehart and also to a sergeant on the Chowchilla police force of Capehart's alleged involvement in the Kennedy assassination or events surrounding it. We've also seen the allegation by this lady friend of Capehart's, or former lady friend, that his face was among those photographs being shown as people being sought as possible conspirators by the House Select Committee. Also, Capehart showed her a handgun with a silencer, automatic firearms, a cyanide pistol, and passports under an assumed name. And at this point, things begin to get really interesting. Continuing with this article. Then, the woman brought Fore a sheet filled with what appeared to be ciphers. She said she had found it in Capehart's papers. Fore added it to his file. In early 1979, while the House Assassinations Committee was in full-bore operation, Fore traveled to Washington to attend an FBI training course, a routine career assignment for many local law enforcement officers. While there, he called up committee staffers and told them his tale. They seemed interested and took his information, including the cipher sheet. When he finished his training course several weeks later, Four stopped by and asked to have his evidence back. The FBI agents who had interviewed him at the time gave him some of it, but kept the code sheet, saying the ciphers were, quote, classified government codes, unquote. When Four got back to Madera County, he heard that the committee office he had visited had been burglarized and the evidence he had given the committee's investigators had been stolen. In July of 1979, the Assassinations Committee concluded that conspiracies were, quote, likely, unquote, in Kennedy's death, but 17 years later, no government agency has confirmed or refuted that conclusion. By the way, I would note that the House Select Committee on Assassinations, although badly compromised, concluded that there was a 95% probability of a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, and among other things, they recommended to the U.S. Department of Justice that they investigate David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. That was the main focal point and the primary focal point of Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. It was Garrison's ultimate vindication, and yet that has continued to be ignored even by many assassination investigators. Continuing. In 1989, Four and Minier prepared to interview Capehart at his home in Nevada. A few hours before they were to meet him, Capehart, 64, dropped dead of a heart attack. Quote, after he died, unquote, Minier said, things kind of dried up in terms of information, and so there was nothing else to do but ask the CIA about it, unquote. So far, the CIA is saying nothing about Claude Capehart. I would note a number of similarities between this story and the situation of Richard Case Nagel, as related in the Oswald and the CIA article that we read earlier in this series. Note that just before there was to be an interview of Claude Capehart, he died apparently of natural causes. People do die of heart attacks in their mid-60s, as Nagel and Claude Capehart apparently did, and yet it is also a long-standing and verified capability of not only ours but other intelligence services that they, in fact, can simulate heart attacks and other causes of natural death. Also note the burglary of the office where some of the information that that Sergeant Four had given the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Also note, too, that apparently the cipher code that Capehart had was of a bona fide U.S. intelligence code. At least that would be the logical conclusion we could draw from the CIA's unwillingness to release it. And there also would appear certainly to be an element of cover-up with regard to Claude Capehart, whatever his possible involvement in the assassination may have been. Note also some of the similarities between that story and a story that I'm about to read concerning new developments in the ongoing investigation into the assassination of Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy's brother. In The Guns of November, as well as Radio Free America program number 9, I have noted the numerous connections between the assassination of Robert Kennedy and that of his brother John, the president. The following story is from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, June 24th of 1996. This is an AP story by Michael Fleeman, F-L-E-E-M-A-N. It's Dateline Los Angeles and headlined, Trial over RFK Photos Begins This Week. It reads, on assignment for his high school newspaper one June night in 1968, Scott Enyart, E-N-Y-A-R-T, pointed his Nikon at Robert F. Kennedy and saw history through a 50-millimeter lens. Quote, all of a sudden, Enyart recalls, he dropped from the frame, unquote. What Enyart witnessed in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel were the last frantic moments in the life of a man who might have been president. Enyart's photographs could potentially show so much, answer so many questions about a case that has been dogged by allegations of incompetent investigation and cover-up. But the photos, Enyart says, are missing. In a lawsuit against the city that is scheduled for trial this week, Enyart alleges the pictures, among 108 frames of film he says he exposed that night, were either lost or sold by the Los Angeles Police Department. Enyart, now 43 and a special effects man for the movies, wants the city to give his photos back or, at the very least, fork over some of the money he says he could have made from the dramatic images. He accuses the city of putting up three decades of roadblocks to cover its actions in the Kennedy investigation. The city contends the pictures exist only in Enyart's teenage imagination, that whatever photos he took at the ambassador were returned to him as prints. The negatives, the city alleges, were lost in an unfortunate theft earlier this year. On June 5th, 1968, Enyart was taking pictures for the Fairfax High School Gazette at Kennedy's celebration after winning California's Democratic presidential primary. When Kennedy finished his speech in the hotel ballroom, Enyart followed the New York senator into a nearby kitchen pantry. He says he was snapping him in profile when Kennedy suddenly twisted out of the viewfinder and turmoil erupted. Police confiscated Enyart's film. He says it was 3 36 exposure rolls and interviewed the youngster at a police station. Enyart received about 24 prints from the police. None of those photos are among the ones he considers most important, those showing the scene in the pantry immediately after the shooting. He told the investigators he had sealed all evidence in the case for 20 years. Enyart waited until the late 1980s, then requested return of all his photos. Quote, "They would at least corroborate or disprove the theories that are out there and, to me, put the whole thing to rest," unquote, he says. These theories include dark suggestions that Saran Saran did not act alone, that a second weapon was involved, that police bungled the investigation or covered up crucial facts. Enyart filed suit, the city said it didn't have his film, and he failed to turn up any trace of his negatives independently. Then, city attorneys reported finding the negatives misfiled under the wrong name in the state archives in Sacramento. They sent Enyart a proof sheet they said was made from the archive negatives and arranged for a courier to deliver the negatives to him. Then, things took a turn for the weird. The courier claimed the package of negatives was stolen from his rental car in Inglewood. Now, all Enyart has left is a proof sheet and a lot of suspicions. So indeed, there are some superficial similarities between the case of Claude Barnes Capehart and the Enyart situation. Note that the information that was the bone of contention appears to have been the focal point of a burglary or black bag job in each case. And once again, note the strange circumstances that continue to surround the ongoing investigations into our political assassinations. The full story of the Robert Kennedy assassination can be gleaned from RFA number 9, the long archive show that I did about the Robert Kennedy assassination. We're going to continue to update the investigation into the assassination of John Kennedy in our next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.